and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the revelations in the new book, Peril, by the Washington Post reporters Woodward and Costa, that makes it alarmingly clear how close we came to a coup on January the 6th, not so much by the actions of the mob, but by a memo written by a top Federalist in the White House, John Eastman. He offered a plan to exploit holes in the Electoral Count Act of 1887 to have Vice President Pence overturn the election and nullify 81 million votes for Biden. Daniel Goldberg, legal director of the Alliance for Justice, who served as chief of staff of the Department of Justice's Office of Legislative Affairs, and before that spent 6 years as senior counsel to Senator Tom Harkin, joins us. We'll discuss the failure of the political establishment and the press to name and shame highly placed Republican lawyers like Eastman, who energetically advocated for treason and came close to succeeding, yet are still accepted in polite society and remain the chairman of the Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group at the Federalist Society, which claims to be dedicated to upholding the Constitution. Then we'll look into the shocking parallel with the US and countries like Hungary, where a democratic government has been taken over in an authoritarian electoral coup to install a family kleptocracy. With the Republicans engineering the same process in the service of the Trump family kleptocracy, which could come back in 2024 if the Republicans win control of the House and Senate in 2022, they could enact the Eastman memo, which came close to being implemented in 2020. Jason Stanley, a professor of philosophy at Yale and author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them, joins us. Then finally, we'll speak with Zachary Carter, a writer in residence at the Omidyar Network's Reimagining Capitalism Initiative, who spent 10 years as a senior reporter at the Huffington Post, where he covered economic policy and American politics. The author of The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes, he joins us to discuss his op-ed at the New York Times, Why Are Moderates Trying to Blow Up Biden's Centrist Economic Plan? And before we go to our first guest, while Background Briefing remains a nationally syndicated radio program with a growing national and international audience, we are relying more and more on our online and podcast audience to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now, Daniel Goldberg, who is the legal director at the Alliance for Justice. Prior to joining the Alliance for Justice, Mr. Goldberg served as chief of staff in the Department of Justice's Office of Legislative Affairs. And before joining the Justice Department, he spent 6 years as a senior counsel to Senator Tom Harkin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Goldberg.
Thank you. Honored to be joining you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And if you're in the intersection, if you will, between the Justice Department and the Congress, it seems that there are gaping holes in the Electoral Count Act of 1887, which governs how Congress counts electoral college votes, because we're just learning now from this new book, Peril, by the Washington Post, Bob Woodward and Robert Costa, how we came close to a kind of coup by memo, if you will, from a conservative lawyer, John Eastman, with the Claremont Institute out here in California. So, I mean, I'm alarmed by it. How does it strike you?
What I find alarming is John Eastman, who, let's remember, also spoke at the Trump rally that led to the violent storming of the Capitol on January 6th, is the chairman of the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group. As you alluded to, he's a well-respected teacher at the Claremont Institute. He travels in the elitist of elitist conservative legal practices. This is the Federalist Society, which he's a senior member of, it should remember, is the group that Trump outsourced selection of lifetime federal judges to, including Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. And it is quite scary that you saw from John Eastman a blueprint for sedition, for toppling an elected government. He put forward a blueprint for the overthrow of our republic. And it wasn't just on John Eastman. Remember, 13 out of 17 Republican attorney generals joined Texas in asking the courts to overturn the election. Senators Hawley, Lee Cruz, all sit on the Senate Judiciary Committee. These were all individuals who supported Donald Trump and efforts to overturn the election. So I hope that the American people are not just focusing on one memo, however deeply troubling and quite frankly ludicrous in its legal analysis that memo was, but they're focusing on an effort by the Republican Party, top to bottom, at the elite levels, to conduct a coup and disregard the democratically elected president.
But surely we should, I mean, there's obviously been a lot of focus on the mob that stormed the Capitol on January the 6th, and there's obviously FBI is looking into several hundred cases, and you even had a rather pathetic rally last Saturday in support of these people, and the narrative is underway to change the whole thing and turn the people who stormed the Capitol, mm-hmm. you know, who are essentially traitors, into martyrs and heroes and patriots. But my feeling is that we should focus less on the mob and more on people like Eastman and the enablers, and maybe even find out who financed a lot of this stuff.
I think you're exactly right. Look, the January 6th coup attempt, including Eastman's memo, though, we also have to remember is just one part of a broader effort to degrade our democracy. Since Bush v. Gore, ultra-conservative justices on the Supreme Court have repeatedly sided with Republicans to make it easier to suppress and undermine the right to vote. They've greenlit partisan gerrymanders that aid Republicans. They've greenlit voter purges. Just weeks ago, the Republican-appointed justices on the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, years after Shelby County when they originally gutted the Voting Rights Act. The fact is that the Republican Party right now is incredibly unpopular. You don't win elections wanting to end rights for women, take away health insurance from millions, including people with pre-existing conditions, giving tax breaks to millionaires. That doesn't win elections. So John Eastman, the entire Republican elite establishment, is taking every step they can to undermine our democracy, whether that's making it harder for African Americans to vote or putting forth a memorandum to permit the Vice President of the United States to handpick who wins an election, disregarding the votes of millions. So I think it's so important what you said, that the people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th are contemptible, should be prosecuted to the fullest under the law, but they are just the tip of the iceberg for a grand strategy by conservative elites in this country to do whatever they can to stay in power, regardless of the desires of the majority of the American people.
And again, I'm speaking with Daniel Goldberg, who is the legal director at the Alliance for Justice. And prior to joining the Alliance for Justice, he served as chief of staff of the Department of Justice's Office of Legislative Affairs. And before joining the Justice Department, he spent 6 years as a senior counsel to Senator Tom Harkin. So just though to touch on the Electoral Count Act of 1887 and the fact that it's obviously got some serious holes in it, obviously it's difficult to fix these holes, and if it's in the Constitution, it's a pretty heavy lift. I mean, there's talk of doing something about it, because if the Republicans win in 2022 and 2024, and they've done enough voter suppression and gerrymandering to make that more than possible, in fact, make it likely. The scenario of the John Eastman memo that was discussed in the White House by Trump, Pence, and Eastman, and then 4 days before the storming of the Capitol, Mike Lee received this memo outlining how Vice President Pence could essentially turn the election over to Trump. This is according to the new book. And apparently both Lee and Senator Graham seriously looked into how they could do that. And fortunately, they both decided, along with Pence, to stick with the Constitution and stick with Democratic norms. But if the Republicans were to take over in 2022 and then in 2024 and control the House and the Senate, they could go ahead and do what they almost did in 2020, right?
Well, I think you lay out what is truly scary. Remember, while Pence did not go along with this, and kudos to former Vice President Dan Quayle, who purportedly advised him not to. But what's scary is if you look at the votes on January 6th, including after the insurrection at the Capitol, Republican legislator after the Republican legislator stood up to deny Joe Biden's rightly earned electoral votes. That, again, whether justices on the Supreme Court, the Federalist Society, who has handpicked judges, or legal elites like John Eastman, who for some reason continues to be allowed back into polite society after laying out in a memo how to topple an elected government, that you really do have a party that has demonstrated that if they are given the reins of power, they will do whatever they can, including conducting a coup to stay in power. I think it's important to go back what's actually in Eastman's memo. Eastman suggested that Pence could announce the existence of an ongoing dispute in seven states, despite the fact that not a single state sent more than one official slate of electors. That what they were saying is the mere fact that Donald Trump and Vice President Pence would say that we don't like the results from one state, so that we're going to ignore them, or in that case, seven states, is quite a scary proposition, and really shows the contempt they have for the American people and our democracy. And sadly, too many of the elites in the Republican Party, not just the people who stormed the Capitol, but the people writing memos, the people selecting our judges, the people going to Federalist Society conventions, seem to share that contempt for the American people.
And in terms of the Electoral Count Act of 1887, it is a little vague, and this is what Eastman and Pence and Trump were seizing on. It says that if the electors in the election failed, as opposed, I mean, you could substitute the word election fraud, because you know they've been making this stuff up, and they've had this recount in Arizona that goes on endlessly because they simply can't reveal the fact that the whole thing is a fraud. But that hasn't stopped what's happening with legislators in the Republican legislature in Pennsylvania now going after their results. I mean, there's a relentless nature to this. Now, I know about the power behind the throne at the Federalist Society, Leonard Leo, and the extent to which, as a member of Opus Dei, he's motivated by very conservative Catholicism and obviously wants to ban abortions in this country, and may well have succeeded since he's gotten Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett on the court. But what makes people like Eastman tick, and why do these lawyers, who presumably, and they talk about the original intent, they're originalists in terms of the Constitution, and they wrap themselves in all this constitutional glory, yet at the same time, they're behaving no different from the way the Nazis did in the 1930s when they took over the parliament in Germany, and the way that Orban in Hungary has done I mean, we've seen this happening around the world. We saw the phony elections that Putin had for the parliament in Russia over the weekend, where he clearly wants the patina of democracy, but makes sure, and in fact is getting even more brazen in the way that he rigs the vote. The Republicans are not, they're being pretty brazen about rigging the vote now. So this is what I don't understand, is can you name and shame these people? Have we lost track of what our democracy is and what it stands for?
Well, I do think, first of all, I'm not going to perhaps go as far as you and compare them to 1930s Germany. But I do think they are, as I said earlier, they are advancing an incredibly unpopular agenda. Taking away health care from people with pre-existing conditions does not win you re-election. Taking away rights from millions of women in Texas does not win you re-election. On issue after issue, their agenda is out of step with the majority of the American people. And it seems they have made a determination that instead of moderating their positions, instead of compromising in certain areas, trying to win a majority of the public, that they will undermine our democracy, that they will make it harder for people to vote, that they'll gerrymander districts. And so however unpopular their positions are and out of step with the majority of the people in their districts or their states, they can't lose elections because they've rigged elections. So I think the American people have to be vigilant. The Democratic senators and the White House need to be vigilant. Kudos to Democratic senators for pushing critical legislation to improve our democracy and to protect the right to vote. Now it's time to end the filibuster and get that bill on Joe Biden's desk. We the American people don't have to be passive in the face of these efforts to undermine our democracy. Because you're right, they have shown their cards, whether a memorandum for John Eastman or ultra-conservative Republican appointees on the Supreme Court making up constitutional principles to undermine the Voting Rights Act. And it's on us to become galvanized and make it clear to the people who are in power right now that they need to pass, for example, critical voting rights legislation.
So just in the last minute then, Daniel Goldberg, could you make the case that we actually have a secession underway? Not a bloody civil war like the last secession, but a kind of political and judicial secession where a minority in this country can create a system of the tyranny of the minority using the courts that have been stacked by the Federalist Society. Because it's pretty clear that in, you know, people like governors, the governors of Florida and Texas, etc., they don't want to live with the rest of America the way it is. They don't like multiculturalism. They've demonized Democrats as socialists, etc., and they're doing all this blatant vote rigging. Is that the agenda, and could they pull it off?
Well, look, we saw from John Eastman, and John Eastman put in place a blueprint for sedition, for toppling a duly elected government. And as you alluded to, states like Florida, Texas, effort after effort to put in place draconian voter laws, to make sure that persons of color, young people, the most vulnerable in our society, cannot exercise the franchise. They are doing all they can to entrench a minority in power, not allow the democratic system to work. These are very scary times when a purportedly well-respected lawyer, member of the Federalist Society, which has a seat, who had a seat at the White House, not only a seat, but was in charge of picking judges at the White House, when they are all on board with this anti-democratic agenda, it is quite scary times we live in.
Well, Daniel Goldberg, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And again, I'm speaking with Daniel Goldberg, who's the legal director at the Alliance for Justice. And prior to joining the Alliance for Justice, he served as chief of staff of the Department of Justice's Office of Legislative Affairs. And before joining the Department of Justice, he spent 6 years as a senior counsel to Senator Tom Harkin. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the shocking parallel with the US and countries like Hungary, where a democratic government has been taken over by an authoritarian electoral coup to install a family kleptocracy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Jason Stanley, the Jacob Urowski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University and the author of How Propaganda Works. And his latest book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jason Stanley.
Thanks. It's good to be on again, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And you know, about a third of the country would like to secede from the Union. We actually have a new civil war. It's not one involving muskets and cavalry and pickets, etc., but it's one that basically at least a third of the population in this country simply don't want to live with the other two-thirds. They don't like multiculturalism. They don't like abortion, etc., and Texas is kind of emblematic of that. So when you think about that, and then you add to that this new radical Republican Party, and then we get this latest revelation from this new book by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa, Peril, where they reveal how close we came to an actual coup on January the 6th, or, you know, on that very day, there was a meeting in the White House with Vice President Pence, Donald Trump, and this lawyer, John Eastman, who provided a roadmap of how Pence doesn't have to certify the vote and how, in fact, they could overturn the vote of the American people. Obviously not legal or not constitutional, but it could be done. It came down to Pence himself, and apparently Pence was talked out of it by, of all people, Dan Quayle. So is that your understanding of what happened on that fateful day?
Well, I mean, I'll take Woodward's word for it. It seems persuasive, and it seems that we should have, something like that was happening to all of us. It seemed like something like that was happening. As to the one third of the country wanting to secede, I think that's an unhelpful way to think of it. I think that the Republicans understand that they cannot win national elections and that they must go after democracy. And so I think what we have is a situation where a third of the country realizes it will be a permanent minority. And so they are turning against democracy and trusting their Republican leaders to overthrow democracy and replace it with autocracy, one-party rule, domination of the courts, despite the fact, and this will only get more intense as the majority of the country, as looks to be the case, turns more and more against the radical policy agendas of the Republican Party. So what we have is an anti-democratic far-right movement and led by extreme elites. So what I think we have to look at now is the fact that, you know, Elise Stefanik graduated from Harvard. She's going around endorsing the big lie that Trump was robbed of the election. Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, J.D. Vance, these are the elite of the elite of the elite. And they're going around saying, endorsing obviously claims that are untethered from reality. And other revelations show us that everyone knows that they're untethered from reality because this one third of the country wants to seize control. And so that's much more important to them than democracy.
Well, you have to add to this list, though, this Claremont Institute senior fellow, John Eastman, this lawyer who came up with this six-point memo that really is a roadmap for how Pence could have essentially thrown the election to Trump, thrown it to the House of Representatives, and according to the Constitution, the count would have been done by the state legislatures across the country, which, of course, are dominated by Republicans.
Yes, that's correct. The Claremont Institute is so reactionary, so extreme far right. When people talk about universities being hotbeds of leftism, they need to think about the Claremont Institute, which partnered and similar professors all over the country. Claremont Institute, its fellows partnered with the Trump administration to try to actually have a coup in the world's oldest democracy. So there should be consequences for that, I think. There won't be consequences. But I think when you look at an institute like the Claremont Institute and people say, oh, you know, it's important, they're conservatives. They're not conservatives. Conservatives are for keeping the traditions, in particular the democratic traditions. What we have now is a social and political movement that is not conservative. It's seeking a revolution, transformative, anti-democratic change. And that is going to attract academics. It's going to attract elites. It's going to attract everyone who realizes that democracy threatens their self-interests. So what you're going to see is you're going to see far-right, proto-fascist academics and intellectuals join with an increasingly extreme evangelical white Christian movement plus billionaires to overthrow democracy. And that's what we're seeing in the United States right now.
So we saw the mob on January the 6th, the American equivalent of the brown shirts. But there was a memo behind the mob, and that is John Eastman. And that had a really good chance of succeeding had Dan Quayle not persuaded his friend Mike Pence, the vice president, to stick with American Constitution and with honoring the votes of the American people. They were about to toss out 81 million American votes. And then the other missing part of it, you mentioned the oligarchs and the right-wing money behind these movements. We don't really know exactly at this point about the funding of January the 6th, do we? And hopefully we will find something out from this special committee that the House has underway. Even though the Republicans boycotted it, it's still doing something. And I assume, at least I hope, that we'll find out something more about the role of this sort of plutocratic populism that we have today.
So I think that when we look at January 6th, we need to find out who funded it, etc. But that was very much a short-term plan. We face several serious interlocking problems. How did people not take the coup seriously? It wasn't just the Eastman memo. Remember when the speakers of the two houses of Michigan went to the White House essentially to discuss with Trump whether they should send an alternative slate of electors and void Michigan's Democratic voice. So there were many steps in Georgia as well. There were many steps where this coup could have succeeded. And the first problem we face is reality denial. Why were so many people mocking the claim that what was happening before our eyes wasn't happening? That should shock everyone. It should shock Ross Douthat, who's a very intelligent conservative commentator in mid-October or late October, had a New York Times column called "There Will Be No Trump Coup." The coup is still ongoing. What we have now is right in front of our eyes. We have changing electoral laws. We have Republicans taking over lower level precinct election controls. We have these massive voter suppression efforts. And then most worrisomely, licensing the state legislatures to send alternative groups of electors if they find any supposed malfeasance. And then we have all this training, hysteria training, of people to show up at school boards to complain about critical race theory 1 month, to complain about mask mandates another month. It's training. They're training people. So who's funding all of this? The rallies are happening in front of school boards right now. The money is flowing to the changing of laws to make the next coup go smoothly. So it's happening, and the reality denial and the level of elites during the time when the coup was very obviously happening continues. So I'm extremely concerned about the lack of taking what's going on seriously. And, you know, all the questions you ask are apropos, not just about January 6th, but about the ongoing attack on democracy.
And again, I'm speaking with Jason Stanley, the Jacob Urowsky Professor of Philosophy at Yale University and the author of How Propaganda Works. His latest book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And you and I have talked about how fascism works in your book, and obviously a lot of it is focused on the historical record of the Nazis and how much that record applies to the possibility of today. A lot of people think that that's overwrought. But now, in this discussion we're having now, when the evidence is so clear, it's not overwrought. It's actually frighteningly possible, is it not?
Absolutely. So people say, look, there's no genocide on the horizon, so it can't be fascism. That would mean that Hitler wasn't a fascist in 1936 because there was no genocide on the horizon. That would mean that the Nazi government was not fascist in 1935, 1938, before there was a genocide. So, I mean, there were only 20,000 people in concentration camps in the mid-30s in Germany. It was still fascism. So it's fascism when there's an anti-democratic far-right movement focusing on a leader, adoration of a leader, and purging of anyone who supposedly betrays the leader, that is based on an ultra-nationalism that targets abortion rights, trans rights, and minority and movements for minority equality. I mean, one of the most powerful ministries in the Nazi Party was the Ministry on Homosexuality and Abortion.
And this is happening before our eyes. And frankly, I don't know what the Democrats can do to stop it. I mean, the voter suppression is so multi-layered and so effective. Because you've got the voter suppression on voting day, you've got before voting day, you've got gerrymandering, which means that the Republicans will pick up the House before one vote is cast. Then you've got voter suppression on voting day. And then after voting day, you've got these Republican legislatures that just can count and certify the vote. And if they don't like it, they can overturn it. And then you've got this activity that you mentioned earlier, Jason, where you have this project that Steve Bannon started, where you've got Republican activists taking over the normally neutral vote counting in this country. And we've seen the mirror of that in this phony vote recount in Arizona and the kind of crazy people that are showing up there to take over voting. Well, that's happening at a national level. And a poll recently said that half of the traditional neutral poll workers are now being harassed and giving up their jobs. And that's a part of the strategy that Bannon has come up with. So all this is happening. I don't see a concurrent alarm in the American populace, and particularly with the loyal opposition, in the sense that we all of us should be realizing the extent to which American democracy itself is under threat.
Well, this is why I'm raising the alarm about the sort of bizarre reality denial that's happening. I mean, when it was on hyperdrive, when there was an obvious coup happening, many elites were mocking it. They were denying it, mocking it, calling it alarmist to even use that language. Now that we know how close we came, they're ignoring the unfolding disaster we face. So the first thing is that people have to understand that we're watching a slow motion coup happening. And the second thing is, you know, we're tired. I'm tired, Ian. I don't know about you, but you know, everyone needs a break, and so there's some desire for a break. But that's an obstacle to stopping this. I don't know how to stop it, but the effort we put in right now will pay off later. So we somehow have to find a method of countering this takeover of our democracy. And it might be too late, frankly. It might be too late. But the first thing we've got to do is stop denying reality, The mainstream media has to stop both siderism. That's a huge problem. You know, we had a large swath of the mainstream media not calling it what it is. And now they're just eager. I think what's happening is a lot of institutions are looking at the future and thinking, oh, maybe there will be a right-wing takeover. And so we better be well-positioned to be on their good side. So that might be a better reading of what's happening with the both-siderism, because, you know, this should be on the front page every day.
Well, the House of Representatives of the Democrats have introduced the Protecting Our Democracy Act, which would limit the president's pardon powers, strengthen laws to ban presidents from receiving gifts or payments from foreign governments, protect independent agency watchdogs and whistleblowers, and give Congress better ability to enforce subpoenas. This is all in response to Trump. When you say we're tired, and I agree, I'm tired. I don't want to even mention the word Trump again, but I have to. The guy has not gone away. He's back, and he is ruthless and relentless. And for some reason or other, the entire Republican Party has gone along with him. Even those that stood up to him and did the right thing, and not so much Pence, but Senator Graham, Senator Lee, they dismissed the fraud allegations. McConnell, shortly after January the 6th, made an absolutely excoriating speech condemning Trump for January the 6th. And so did McCarthy, the minority leader in the House. They've all turned around now and are completely supine and submissive to Trump. So what's happened? It is cult-like. It is Hitler-like. It's frightening.
It is. And we had a massive failure of our media and intellectual class. Not you. But others. I mean, Corey Robin, an intellectual I greatly respect, said Trump is going to be like Jimmy Carter, a one-term president who fades away, never to be heard from again, who has no, I mean, you know, who won't have an effect on national politics, an incredibly weak president. I mean, our intellectual class has failed us. Our media has failed us of frankly warning the American public what this is. And so, you know, the constant delusional thinking, a delusional thinking we saw during COVID as well, not seeing that what you have is a proto-fascist movement with a fascist leader, the failure to name it, call it what it is, and the constant desire to not see, to not confront reality. I think, you know, in admiration of the Republican Party, I mean, folks like Holly, Cruz, J.D. Vance, they know exactly what's happening. They're going to end democracy. it's you know, it's the pundits, the New York Times, the you know, even on the left, people who refuse to see what's right before our eyes. And so that's, we need some truth tellers out there, some people who look at reality and say, America's not unique. America is not this exceptional thing that can withstand what every other nation falls prey to, namely an autocratic dictator who wants to take over, who wants to transform. You hear Trump supporters talking about him. They love him. And he's a good demagogue. He's excellent at this.
Right. And his helpers and handlers, and I guess you have to certainly bring up Rupert Murdoch in this context, because without the Fox News and right-wing media and the echo chamber, that they keep Trump's supporters in this bubble of delusion. They are equally important. And of course, you saw recently that Fox News's top guy, Tucker Carlson, was spent a week broadcasting from Hungary, where he hung out with the despot there, who's already shown the roadmap. And along with the Eastman roadmap we talked about earlier, the Orban roadmap is pretty clear of electoral autocracy and how you take over a country with the patina of democracy. The same thing, of course, we just had elections in Russia, where Putin, for some reason or other, still wants to have the pretense of democracy, even though he's more and more brazen about how he rigs the vote. The Republicans are equally brazen about how they're rigging the vote in 2022 and 2024. And that's what I find absolutely astounding, is where's the outrage?
Where's the outrage? Exactly. I think the explanation is this reality denial. The Republicans know what they're doing. They're explicit about what they're doing. They're going to Hungary, which is exactly the model. Hungary is a Orban uses social conservative, anti-gay, anti-trans, anti-foreigner, anti-Muslim, xenophobic rhetoric, represents himself as being pro-Christian and pro-family. But you know what Hungary is? It's a kleptocracy. His family members, he has family members who are billionaires now. It's a kleptocracy. And so we're being told by Tucker Carlson, we want America to be a kleptocracy. We're going to use the Christianity, the right-wing, the social conservatism stuff as a mask to rob you blind.
And the Trump family, they're just waiting in the wings.
Absolutely.
And they've shown their proclivity to kleptocracy, that's for sure. I thank you for joining us, Jason Stanley. I feel like we have to stay in touch and keep pointing out this reality.
As always, Ian, thanks for doing the work.
And again, I've been speaking with Jason Stanley, the Jacob Urowski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University and the author of How Propaganda Works. And his latest book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with Zachary Carter about his op-ed in the New York Times, Why Are Moderates Trying to Blow Up Biden's Centrist Economic Plan? And joining us now, Zachary Carter, writer in residence with the Omidyar Network's Reimagining Capitalism Initiative. He spent 10 years as a senior reporter at the Huffington Post, where he covered economic policy and American politics, and is the author of The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. Welcome to Background Briefing, Zachary Carter.
Thanks so much for having me.
And your article in the New York Times is titled, Why Are Moderates Trying to Blow Up Biden's Centrist Economic Plan? And short of having suicidal tendencies, what explains this action on the part of the Democrats? Because to some extent, we saw it back in 2008 when Obama came in and they had the trifecta. They controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House with a substantial majority vote for the new president. And yet he was stalled all along, particularly by his own party, particularly when it came to his signature healthcare proposal.
Well, you know, I think the specifics of each of these situations, whether it's the Obamacare fight or today's struggle to pass President Biden's economic agenda, the specifics vary a bit. But I think in the sort of broad strokes, the contemporary issue here is different from what was going on under Obama ideologically. Under Obama, centrists were working to take somewhat progressive policy and make it more conservative. Under Biden, you look at what these moderates are criticizing in the bill, and they're actually proposals that moderates have supported for a long time, often as alternatives to other progressive programs. But the broad push here is for economic relief and support from Biden as the sort of engine of political healing for all the other crises that have been plaguing American democracy and indirectly the Democratic Party, the rise of inequality, the breakdown of foreign policy on multiple continents. The idea is that having a lot of attention and care to the economy will alleviate a lot of these other pressures without having to resort to some sort of structural political reform. And yet the centrists in the Democratic Party are so accustomed to sort of paring back what they perceive as a progressive president's agenda. They're almost sort of cutting the bill by default as sort of a matter of habit without reflecting on what they're really cutting. What we're seeing, I think, is not so much an expression of centrism from these folks as an expression of conservatism in the sense of a fear of change. There really aren't even centrist sort of ideological critiques that the centrists are making of Biden's agenda. They just want to see it shrink.
So without sounding conspiratorial, is it a case where the kind of establishment, for the want of a better description, has it covered. They've got the Republicans in their corner, and they've got this minority of Democrats who, at the end of the day, will make sure that nothing too progressive gets passed. I mean, I'm reading, of course, on a lot of these progressive websites, articles about the Farmer Three, these three Democratic congressmen who are supposedly in the pocket of Big Pharma. And frankly, to my mind, it's more about the systemic nature of our money-driven politics. Our legislatures are essentially telemarketers who spend their days dining for dollars. And I imagine a lot of them at some point or other just decide to take money from, you know, a big donor who's reliable.
Well, I think it'd be naive to deny that this is a feature of American politics and that it's been a problem with this particular bill. The prescription drug price reform that you brought up there, three Democrats joined with Republicans on a House committee to torpedo this prescription drug price reform. The idea is to allow Medicare to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies the way the public health systems of other countries negotiate with pharmaceutical companies as well. So by negotiating these with these companies, you get lower prices. That's designed to save the government money. And yet one of the reasons that Kathleen Rice, one of the moderates who voted against this plan, offered up for why she had taken the position she had taken on this legislation was that she was deeply concerned about fiscal responsibility. Well, if you're deeply concerned about fiscal responsibility, then you wouldn't be voting against things that save the government money. Now, fiscal responsibility may or may not be the most important thing in this package. I tend to think that the president's emphasis on the deficit neutrality of this legislation, that he's going to pay for every dollar of spending with a dollar in savings or tax increases somewhere else, I think that's a bit misguided and has sort of boxed him into some procedural corners with his own party here. But you can see the critiques that people are making about the legislation within the Democratic Party, within Joe Biden's own Democratic Party, just don't make a whole lot of sense on their, you know, by the goals of the people, according to the goals of the people making the critiques. I think that's unusual compared to the Obamacare debate. You know, people would say things like, oh, it's too expensive, and it would be pretty clear that maybe that particular politician was very close to, say, the U.S. health insurance industry. But the claim that something was too expensive would at least be paired with a policy that cost a lot of money. You're not seeing that from the critiques that are being offered up right now. I think the Democratic Party has gotten into a strange place where a lot of the members who are elected believe that their political fortunes depend a lot on political optics as understood by people inside the Beltway who specialize in studying political optics. So how close you are to the president, how far you are from the president, how into making change you are versus how resistant to change you are, rather than looking at sort of the ideological makeup of any particular proposal. There are always going to be people who are afraid of change, but typically that is a position we associate with conservatism in American discourse. We don't think of doing nothing or just doing less as inherently a moderate or centrist kind of approach.
And again, I'm speaking with Zachary Carter, a writer in residence at the Omidyar Network's Reimagining Capitalism Initiative. He spent 10 years as a senior reporter at the Huffington Post, where he covered economic policy and American politics, and is the author of The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Why Are Moderates Trying to Blow Up Biden's Centrist Economic Plan? So in terms of the Big Pharma Three, are they basically making a calculus? Is that they're better off going along with their lobbyists who are taking care of their re-election campaign, or are they somehow thinking that their constituents won't notice? Because you've made it clear, and it is obviously clear, that the prescription drug benefits was a package that came through in George W. Bush's era. It was a complete pork barrel piece of legislation that's led Big Pharma to the trough, and they're just scooping up federal dollars, and to get rid of it and to bring about competition so you can get cheaper generics makes so much more sense, and it helps the American people, it helps their pocketbook, and it helps the deficit. So how can they make that calculus that they're better off siding with the lobbyist as opposed to their own constituents?
Well, I think it, you know, each member of Congress is different, and I haven't had a heart-to-heart with any of these three about the specifics of their their vote. Kathleen Rice did write a letter to a constituent explaining hers that that I've been relying on for some of my reporting. But there is a school of thought in American politics that voters care a lot more about the sort of social identity that comes with belonging to a political party than they do about the specifics of a way that a particular lawmaker votes. And so they're willing to forgive a lot of things that they would otherwise disagree with if they believe that the lawmaker is basically on their kind of social team. So if you identify as a Democrat, you like the Democratic Party, then you're just going to be a little more forgiving of Democrats when they go astray than you would be for a Republican. I mean, I think part of that is there's a soft version of that theory that I think is obviously true. People like their team more than they like the other team. But I also think in something as straightforward and brazen as this, you know, there's a reason why only three Democrats on that committee wanted to take that vote. A lot of people in the Democratic Party get money from Big Pharma. Not all of them are going to oppose prescription drug reform when a Democratic president supports it. But, you know, it is worth pointing to the way to the reelection rates for Democrats. You know, it is very rare for a progressive primary challenge to succeed in Democratic Party politics. It's becoming less rare. And, you know, you've seen members of the squad be elected over the past couple of cycles, but we're still talking a handful of seats out of dozens and dozens of these efforts. So Democrats do tend to reward Democrats just for being Democrats, even when they do things that the Democratic Party rank and file doesn't necessarily, doesn't necessarily like.
So moving beyond the three Democratic House members, the Big Pharma three, Representatives Kurt Schrader, Scott Peters, and Kathleen Rice, that sort of the two big names that would certainly fit into the category of your articles, why are moderates trying to blow up Biden's centrist economic plan, of course, are Senators Manchin and Sinema. And they're sort of all over the map. I mean, Sinema supports the original efforts to prevent all this voter suppression that's going on the part of the Republicans. And now, of course, we've got Manchin's bill that seems to be the only possible avenue that the Democrats have. But then on the other big ticket, the $3.5 trillion reconciliation infrastructure bill, you've got both Manchin and Sinema against it. Manchin actually wants to cut it more than a half, down to $1.5 trillion. And, of course, Sinema was behind the bipartisan bill that stalled in the House because Pelosi and company want to pass the $3.5 trillion before they go along with the bipartisan bill that was previously negotiated. So what's the story there in terms of, again, the same questions would apply to them, but we're often told that Manchin's problem is he comes from a very conservative state that voted 40% for Trump. My understanding about Arizona is that it's trending pretty blue. I mean, is there a possibility that if these two senators get so much flack from the progressive Democrats that they could walk across the aisle and suddenly Mitch McConnell would be the majority leader? Is that possible?
I haven't heard any rumblings to that effect so far. Anything's possible in American politics. But so far as leadership in both the Senate and House are concerned and the actual offices of Manchin and Sinema, there haven't been any sort of threats to that effect for either of them to leave the party. I do think it's the sort of thing that's maybe in the background of leadership's mind when they're working with these folks. But overall, you know, you look at the type of critique that's being launched. I addressed some of Senator Manchin's complaints directly. He published a list of sort of demands in the Wall Street Journal when he asked for the debate on this bill to be paused, which it was not. You know, he was worried about the deficit growing, and he was worried about inflation. And, you know, the deficit's just not an issue on this particular package. I mean, however you feel about the national debt, it just...
It's all about raising taxes, isn't it? Isn't it all about raising taxes? And he's against raising taxes on the rich, isn't he, and corporations?
It could be, you know, I think in some way or other, you're going to see eventually. I still think at this point, some sort of deal on reconciliation is more likely than not on this big $3.5 trillion package that that Biden's been pursuing. I don't know if it'll be 3.5, 3.4, 3, what, but some sort of deal will come to fruition, and that will be paid for with tax increases on the wealthy and corporations in some way or another. So the question is how much, I think. But, you know, if you look at Sinema's objections, she hasn't really tried to make any straightforward policy-oriented critiques of anything in the package. She's just said she thinks it's too big over and over again, and she hasn't really said why she thinks it's too big. And, you know, I think there's a school of thought that says Democratic senators who stand up and give Democratic presidents a really hard time are rewarded for their reasonableness or their moderation by voters. I'm just not so sure that's going to be true this time. Sometimes it is true, I think. But I think this time around, you know, it looks like obstructionism rather than some sort of effort to work across the aisle to build bridges with Republicans. You know, I think to some extent the negotiations over the infrastructure legislation that Manchin and Sinema were deeply involved in probably optically does help them because there were Republicans on board with that piece of legislation. But, you know, one of the reasons you often hear moderates complaining about progressives as obstructionists, as people who want to make the perfect the enemy of the good, all of that, is that this stuff about being an obstructionist is really unpopular in American politics, particularly among Democrats. Democratic voters, they like politicians who get things done. And so I think to some extent this stuff is working from a playbook that doesn't really apply. If Biden, you know, if they were going up against Bernie Sanders and a Medicare for All program and defunding the police, then, you know, I think these types of tactics would make a little bit more sense within that particular school of thought about what is rewarded in American politics. But they're going up against Joe Biden trying to provide more economic support to a country that even Republicans think needs more economic support. I just don't think it's going to work out well for them.
Well, just in closing, I mean, it looks as if the Democrats have got a very narrow window. They've got a very narrow majority in the House and Senate, and they've got a very narrow window if the Republicans, with their voter suppression, will come back in 2022 and 2024 and win without, even before any votes are cast in the House. That's the landscape. So any politician on the Democratic side who scuttles the Democratic agenda at the only moment that they had to get something done before they become, you know, a permanent minority, if the Republicans engineer this one-party state program they appear to have, then, my God, Manchin and Sinema will be vilified in history, surely.
You know, it's always hard to figure out whether senators care about history's verdict or whether they have a clear eye of how historians look at the actions of senators. You know, a lot of senators just get forgotten. There are all sorts of really terrible laws in American history, and very few people can name, you know, the nasty fellows who drafted and supported these horrors. They just sort of fade away. I think it's extremely unlikely anybody will remember Kyrsten Sinema or Joe Manchin in half a century, however they vote on anything. But I think Democratic voters over the next 4 or 5 years might well be very unhappy with them if either one of them single-handedly torpedoed the central planks of a Democratic president's agenda.
Well, Zachary Carter, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Zachary Carter, who's a writer in residence with the Omidyar Network's Reimagining Capitalism Initiative. He spent 10 years as a senior reporter at Huffington Post, where he covered economic policy and American politics. He's the author of The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Why Are Moderates Trying to Blow Up Biden's Centrist Economic Plan? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews, searchable by topic, and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast. And we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Martin Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by